Our next speaker is Dr. David Pelkowitz, also not new to our conference. Dr. Pelkowitz is the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at Yeshiva University at the Israeli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration. Most people know Dr. Pelkowitz as the individual that they called upon, so he's the psychologist, I guess that would be the way to look at it, when there are usually crises. I know that in terms of many of the encounters, both at Yeshiva University, from our children who go to Yeshiva University, when there are some significant crises that have to be dealt with, and at all of the affiliated schools, they tend to call on the expert, Dr. Pelkowitz. It's really a great pleasure and a schus to have Dr. Pelkowitz with us today, and he will be addressing the issue of, as you can have here, bridging the gap. Dr. Pelkowitz. Oh, right in front of me. See you.
Okay. I'm kind of the comic relief here after such prestigious people and brilliant people speaking before me. I'm going to talk about bridging the gap. We all know that there's a huge gap between moral knowledge and moral action. I'm also not going to be directly following the PowerPoint. I'll refer you once in a while to page numbers, like we just heard, but for the most part, I'm gonna talk. Let me start with, maybe I'll start with a brief story about Dr. Coles. Dr. Coles at Harvard had taught three sequential courses in moral development. He authored some of the major works on moral development in children. And a number of years ago, he had a student who was the first student from her town in Western Pennsylvania to go to any college. And she got into Harvard and literally was the hero of the town when she went off to take the train that would ultimately take her to the Boston area. Literally, they had a parade to see her off. And she took Dr. Coles' three courses in moral development, and he developed a relationship with her. And he was shocked when she knocks on his door one day after she did very well in all three of his courses. And she said, "Dr. Coles, I came to say goodbye. I'm leaving the university." He was shocked. He said, "You were such a wonderful student. I know you were the pride of your town. How could you be doing this? It just doesn't make any sense to me." She said, "Let me explain to you where this comes from." She said, "You know who ranked number one in all three courses that you taught?" And he names the name of a well-known name that's on many of the buildings on the Harvard campus. Very wealthy, somebody the third, who comes from an extremely wealthy and respected family. And she says, "Yeah, well, you know, he was ranked number one in all three classes." She says, "Let me tell you about this student of yours." She said, "I didn't get quite enough money in my scholarship to be able to have a complete free ride, so I had to put myself through school by cleaning apartments in the area of Harvard. And one of the apartments that I cleaned was his apartment. He lives in some beautiful penthouse apartment off campus, some magnificent place, and I would go there once or twice a week to clean his apartment. And he and his friends would do everything they possibly could to demean me. They'd have me clean the apartment in a way that kind of literally shamed me for having to do this. They would say cruel and horrible things to me." And then she stands up and looks at Dr. Coles and says, "You know, any institution that has such a disconnect between moral knowledge and moral action, I don't want to be a part of. What I want to do is spend the half hour or so I've been asked to speak going through some thinking about what do we know is actually associated with bridging the gap between moral knowledge and moral action. I'm going to start with a series of books and writings by a sociology professor, that to me I think is so incredibly valuable in answering this part. It's about how we handle our mistakes. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the work of Dr. Olliner. When Dr. Olliner was 6 years old in his town in Europe, one day the Nazis came and in front of him, literally killed every man, woman, and child in the town that he grew up in. His parents, his siblings, everybody he knew. And in the chaos and the unimaginable kind of horror, he wandered off. Somehow he got away. And he goes to the outskirts of the town and eludes the Nazis. And he sees a farmhouse there, and he knocks on the door of the farmhouse. And the owners of the farmhouse immediately recognize this must be a Jewish child who escaped the massacre. And without asking any questions, they take him in and hide him for the rest of the war. Totally treat him like one of their own at incredible risk. We all know that had they been found, everybody they knew would have been killed. They would have been killed. Their children would have been killed. It would have been horrific. And yet they did this. He then, after the war, is sent to America, where he's taken in by some relatives who had survived. And he goes and gets a PhD in sociology. And he and his future wife spend their entire career trying to answer a simple question. What makes for such a moral giant? How could anybody have done this? I've often thought, if I was in that situation, would I have been able to do what these people did? I can't imagine that I could have done it. What does it take? What's the childhood of these righteous Gentiles? And he went and he interviewed every righteous Gentile he could find. And he found some fascinating kind of insights into parenting, but more importantly for this, an internalization of moral values. But the part I want to focus on, it was how mistakes and mess-ups were handled in these families. In a family of a future righteous Gentile, if a mistake was made, and again, you could look at this on page 15, the middle left slide. And here's what he finds. He finds that parents who explained what the child did wrong if they made a mistake. And not only that, they didn't lose it. They didn't yell, they didn't scream, they didn't criticize. They let the child know, we know that you're better than this. We believe in you. We know that you're better than this. Tell us what you did wrong. And without trying to make them feel guilty, they'd say, okay, let's come up with a tshuva plan. Let's come up with a way that you could make good on what you did wrong. It wasn't done with emotionalism. It was done calmly and very clearly, where they weren't let off the hook at all. What they were told very clearly is how to correct the mistake. And it turns out that that emphasis on moral values rather than on specific rules was at the heart of what these families were all about in terms of how they handled mistakes. Let me now tell you the story of Keith Jarrett. Anybody ever hear the name Keith Jarrett? Okay. Here's Keith Jarrett. Keith Jarrett was one of the greatest jazz musicians of all time. And one day in 1975, he was asked to give a concert in Cologne, Germany. 6,000 people were going to be there. It was a sold-out concert. He gets there about 10 hours before to try out the piano. For some reason, I don't understand. You could Google this later to look up about this famous concert. I'll explain to you why you could Google it and why it's relevant in a minute. He comes into the concert hall, and the piano was basically arranged by a 17-year-old girl who was put in charge of getting a piano for this concert. I have no idea why. I have no idea why that big responsibility was put into her hands. But he goes there to try. All of the keys on the left-hand part of the piano were totally unusable. The pads weren't there. They just weren't there. You could hit it as hard as you want, no sound. Same thing for all the keys on the right-hand side. The middle of the piano, the keys there actually do play, but only if you really bang down on it and it's out of tune. So he, of course, tells her, get a new piano. And she goes. She calls everybody she could find. She calls all over. And she can't. It wasn't enough time to get a piano. And he says, okay, we're going to have to cancel the concert. Being a 17-year-old girl, she does what any 17-year-old girl would do who's about to be publicly shamed that way. She has a tantrum. She throws herself on the floor. She cries. She says, my life's going to be over. And he's a soft touch for this. And he couldn't take her tears. And finally, he gives in. And he performs the concert, which today is the number one selling jazz piano concert in history. Download it. It's worth downloading. It's magnificent. Because the challenge, just Google Keith Jarrett, Cologne, Germany, 1975. It's an amazing, amazingly haunting and beautiful concert. You hear him huffing and puffing, but what the challenge brings out in him is brilliance and growth and genius coming from joining and sort of calling on himself with that frustration. Why am I spending so much time on this? Because ultimately, we're living in an age where very often, in the balance between love and limits, we tend to be more love specialists. We're not as good with limits. We're not as good in having our children go through a tshuva process if they mess up, or challenge themselves when things are difficult. And very often, that's the key to growth, it's the key to creativity, and it's the key to Menschlichkeit. It's the key to knowing the right thing to do. Second main point I wanted to talk about, which you'll see a little bit on, again, the same page, page 15 on the right, middle, is the whole idea that empathy is a very slow emotion. If I took the time now to show you a video, to show you, let's say, a picture of a piano, I'll stay with pianos, okay? And I slammed, you saw a picture of somebody slamming the lid of a piano on somebody's fingers. Or it was a picture of a car door slamming on somebody's fingers, everybody here would wince. It's automatic. You wouldn't have to think about it. The empathy would be immediate. We're hardwired to immediately empathize for physical pain. But if I showed you a video of somebody being treated cruelly, somebody being treated in a way that somehow they were literally being the subject of being shamed or bullied or socially excluded, you wouldn't immediately feel empathy. You'd have to work on it. It takes focus. It takes concentration. And it takes not being in a hurry in order to do that. And I'll just quickly end this section with the famous, because I know about it. I don't know how many of you know about it. It's the Princeton Seminary study, and it goes like this. There's a group of seminarians in Princeton who were asked to practice a talk and to give a sermon. They were about to give a drasha on The Good Samaritan, which is basically a story of you're walking down the road and you see somebody in need and they're in pain. Do you stop to help them? Do you stop to help somebody in need, or do you look the other way? Lahavdil, are you over on the Doraisa of Haloma? Were you Mekayim Hakeim Takei Mima? Okay, it's a totally different application. But the question is that basically these seminarians are about to be given a prava. They're about to be tested. They're about to give a drasha on the story of the Good Samaritan, meaning do you stop and help somebody who's in pain if you encounter them when you're walking on the road? And this being a psychological study, these seminarians are walking from one building on the Princeton Divinity School campus to another building to get ready for their test. And psychologists stage a heart attack. They have an MI, right? So somebody is sort of just there on the road in between the two buildings, and he starts gasping, and he's clearly collapsing with what seems to be a life-threatening, some kind of cardiac event. And then the psychologists figure out who stops and helps, who stops and either calls 911 or does CPR or whatever. And it turns out, don't forget, these guys are about to be tested on giving a drasha on exactly this issue, okay? Literally, talk about moral knowledge. They're about to preach on this issue. And guess what? The only predictor as to whether or not these seminarians stopped was how much of a rush they were in. If they were in a rush, they didn't stop. Okay? I've heard from colleagues the beautiful thought given by the Pia Zessner, quoting the Baal Shem Tov, heard this from Moshe Tzvi Weinberg, that when we say in Shema, V'yavadetem Mehera, you know what it means? Al Pidrush, get rid of the rush in your life. Sometimes we have to get rid of the rush in your life. That's the key to this. That's the key to empathy. It's the key to being able to transmit to our children the ability to be Nosei Bolim Chavero. Okay? So that's that second point. Third point, I'm now going to ask you to please go, and here I'm going to stick a little bit more to the text, because otherwise it'll take too long. But before that, actually, I'm going to do on page 16, just briefly, number three. We're going to do expectation, and I'm going to briefly, how much, what's that? No, I think it's okay. I think it'll be, unless you think it's better that I do it, I think we're okay. No, I think because this way I could sort of like wax poetic. So it goes like this. It's the study of Ellen Langer, and I think it's a very important study. You know how you're often funnier if you think that if the person you're with thinks you're funny, you become funnier, right? If the person you're with thinks that you're smart, you become smarter. You ever notice that? And if they think you're dumb, you're going to be dumb, okay? We all know we bounce off each other. Kamayim ha-panam el-panam, our hearts bounce off each other. And that's what the work of Ellen Langer is, which has a lot to do with internalization of moral values. Here's what she did. Professor at Harvard, she takes 8 men in their 70s and 80s. And she takes a monastery that's no longer a monastery, and she converts it to look like time travel. She makes it look like the world looked for these men when they were in their prime, when they were 40 years old, okay? So she basically, it's like time travel. These men are in their 70s and 80s. She puts in black and white televisions, art and wallpaper. It's basically the way the world looked when these men were 40. And she has 8 men spend the week together, and here's what she tells them. Think of yourselves as very much as being 40. Treat each other like you're 40. So the men had a third floor room. They had to bring up their suitcase by themselves to the third floor, no help. even if it meant doing one article of clothing at a time. Fascinating. They literally inhabited the world of younger men for those 5 days. Then after the 5 days, by the way, there's a comparison group that does the same thing, same monastery a week later, but they're treated like old men, okay? So listen to what happens, okay? After only 5 days, if you show pictures to independent raiders of the men in both groups, 100% of the time, these men who were treated like they were younger look younger. After only 5 days, they look younger. But here's where it gets a little harder to understand. Ophthalmologists, an independent team of ophthalmologists, give exams to the 8 men here and to the 8 men in the other group, and their vision significantly improves. I don't know for how long, but their vision of the men treated like they were younger significantly improves. I don't know if there are ophthalmologists here who could explain to me how that could happen. I certainly can't even believe to understand that, okay? So their vision significantly improves. Then all kinds of other tests, manual dexterity, strength, and a newspaper reporter who was invited to cover the study reported on the last day of the study when the men were waiting for a bus to take them home, back to their homes in the Cambridge area, all of the men spontaneously started a game of two-hand touch football. These are men in their 70s and 80s relative to the other group. Now, what does that have to, does that make any sense? I don't think it's easy to make sense, but it's the power of expectations, the power of believing in your child. I'm going to talk about this a little bit more tomorrow night, God willing, at the meal. We talk a little bit about, the power of parents believing in the good of their child and how that could play out in terms of what happens when our childs aren't us. But that maybe I'll make that the end of this section. And now I just want to talk about two other points. Number one, how am I with time? What time did I start? Roughly. Okay. So here's the final two points. The next point is the point of ethical fading. It's a new field, a relatively new field, in the field of neuroethics. Some fascinating research also being done in Boston. And what they find is that as soon as there's negia, almost everybody knows the right thing to do. If you talk to them about what would happen if you were in this situation. Let's say you hear about somebody who's cheated on their taxes, or somebody who cheated on their wife or on their husband, or somebody who was arrested for some kind of fraud. Almost everybody reacts to it, understandably, with saying, how could they do it? And it speaks so poorly about our community. And we it's very easy to judge others, because we always know about, almost everybody knows what's the morally correct thing to do. The problem is, what happens when there's self-interest? What happens when there's negius, okay? We're going to read Pinchas on Shabbos. And there's a fascinating thought by the Chafetz Chaim in Pinchas, where he talks about, the pasuk says that Benos Lavchad come, and they say, Avinu meis b'midbar v'lu haya b'socha eda. So they say to Moshe, Benos Lavchad, he wasn't part of the rebellion against you, our father, Benos Lavchad says. Immediately, according to the Chafetz Chaim, Moshe basically says, I can't deal with this. Now that you told me that he supported me, that your father supported me during that horrible business with Korach and his henchmen, Vayikrav Moshe es mishpatam lefnei Hashem. Chafetz Chaim says, by rights, Moshe should have been able to deal with it. But the second he had negius, he said to himself, I can't think straight. Look a little bit at what some of the current research is on neuroethics. So again, you look on page 16. So you look about the idea of page 16, bottom right slide. In the heat of the moment, we're dominated by a far more emotional and rapidly moving set of unconscious processes that's typically driven by what comes easiest in meeting our personal agenda. Okay? And that's top of page 17. During morally challenging events, we tend to see the trees rather than the forest, details rather than abstract principles, make quick decisions based on immediate feelings rather than calculated thought, and that's basically called ethical fading. You think about it, I'll make it more real to you. I play a game with my grandchildren. It's called ethical dilemma, because the only way to override ethical fading is to think about it ahead of time. Notice it's like you want to have the frontal prefrontal cortex. You want to have the thinking part of the brain in charge. If you don't have the thinking part of the brain in charge and you let your emotions take over, there's going to be negias. There's going to be sort of like self-deception that's going to take over. And we therefore have to think about ethical dilemmas beforehand. So I play a game with my grandchildren. They love it. They beg me to play. What, you know, tell me stories of ethical dilemmas you face during the week. And I tell them stories that are real world stories. And then they tell me about ethical dilemmas they had. My 11-year-old granddaughter was in a summer Pesach program camp. I was a visiting scholar in some Pesach program. And there was a camp in that hotel on the West Coast. And there was a group of girls who were trying to play a trick on the counselor. And they were being mean to the counselor and sort of like not talking to her, not listening to her. So my granddaughter goes running to my daughter and says, Ima, I have an ethical dilemma. What should I do? Okay? And they talked it out, and she figured out, you know what, I can't go along with this. It's not right. It's not bekovedik. It's not right. And she refused to go along with it. For the rest of Yontif, all these girls ignored her because she was the goody-goody. But you know what? We were so incredibly proud of her. And she's really fun. She's really not like that. But you, when you do that, when you bring voice to values, it makes all the difference. When you have time, you could read some of these other things. Let me end with a final point, and it's about the reality that another component, right? So the components that we've done until now have been what components? We've talked about how mistakes are made and how mistakes are handled. We talked about the kind of the power of how empathy is so much a slow emotion and the need to be there and focus, and I'll talk about that in one of my talks later over this weekend where we talk about digital technology and being versus doing, and then we talked about the realities of expectations and Langer in the monastery study, and then about ethical fading and bringing voice to values. The final point, though, is about one of the real ways that values are integrated is what do we get emotional about and what do we spend time about, okay? Think about what are our kids exposed to about what we really care about. What do we really, really care about? What do we spend time on, okay? If what they're hearing around the Shabbos table is us talking about other people in a judgmental way, or us talking about the material, we're talking about things that are basically not the values you want to transmit to our children, then obviously that's going to be what our kids are going to internalize. If what we really care about, what we really get emotional about is what's shared, that's what our kids will really get excited about. I'll end with a story. It's a story of, did you ever hear the story of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach? You could tell me if this is a true story or not, but I heard it from somebody who was there. This is about the Eruv in Bayit Vegan and the time he canceled Shir on a Sunday morning in Kol Torah many years ago. I heard this story from a man in a Rav in Australia who told me this was the single most powerful event in his life. And it shaped who he is, and to this day is something that shaped his ethical and moral and halachic development. So I'll share the story. One Sunday morning, because remember, it's these two ingredients. What do we get emotional about, and what do we spend time on? One Sunday morning, word in Kol Torah comes out that Sunday morning shiur is canceled. They make an announcement, Sunday morning shiur, the Seder is canceled, and the Rosh Shlomo Zalman, the Rosh Yeshiva, wants to talk to the boys. It had never happened before. It's unprecedented to cancel learning on a regular day. Everybody's very worried. And all the boys in the yeshiva go into the Beis Medrash, and it's very silent, and everybody's very nervous. And people could see the Rav Auerbach was very, very shaken, extremely shaken. And they're nervous. And he tells them through his tears, let me tell you what happened yesterday in town. He said it was an extremely hot day, extremely hot day. And it was a very humid day. It's just not, it was not an easy day to be doing physical activity. And he said, I was in town for Shabbos, and there was an ufruf in shul. In the shul, I was going to daven in. And I see the chassan and his father are going to set up the kiddush for the ufruf just before davening. And the father is schlepping like three chairs on one hand and three chairs on the other, and he's huffing and puffing. And his son is walking next to him, and just walking and doing nothing to help his father. And he's going, he's setting up the chairs. And again, the father is sweating and gasping and goes back, gets some more chairs, three on each hand, and the boy is walking, the chassan is walking, not lifting a finger to help his father. Rosh Shlomo Zalman couldn't take it anymore. He stops the boy, stops the chassan, and he says, Kibbutz, Kibbutz, what's wrong with you? Where's your Kibbutz? And he says to all the bachurim, he says, the boy proudly looked up at me and he said, I don't hold from the Seraph. And now Shlomo Zalman breaks down into tears. He's crying. He's crying. And he says, where have we failed you? Where have we failed you? How could we not have taught you the difference between the Doraisa of Kibbutz and whatever Drabbanan of a Drabbanan, whatever it is. Again, I'm just a regular old psychologist. I can't talk about the halachic parts. I'm not going to even pretend to know any of this stuff. I have it easy here, okay? I'm just talking about the psychology part of it. But he's crying. And the man who was there, who's a very prominent Rav in the Southern Hemisphere, tells me, it just shaped me. And what were the two ingredients? What do we spend time on? And what do we care about? Those were the two ingredients that led to that transformation in making this future Rav into the leader of that community. The tears of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and as well as the fact that he thought this was important enough to cancel morning Seder on a Sunday morning in Beit Pagan. So with that, I hope that's not too negative. I'll be positive. The rest of Shabbos, I'll be positive. Thank you, everybody.
Once again, if there's any questions you want to ask Dr. Pelkowitz, please, while I...
Yeah, the question was an excellent question, which is why do we call it ethical fading instead of rationalization? And I was explaining that it's based on some studies, both fMRIs and other kinds of studies done, I think, largely at Harvard, but since then in other places, that show that when self-interest is involved, there's much less rational thinking, and it's a whole other neurologically driven process where we're just not thinking, you know. And I could relate to it. I could relate to it. As soon as there's, you know, it's at a simple level, you know. I'm taking my 10-year-old grandson, let's say, when he was 10, on Long Island Railroad on his 10th birthday. Where before his 10th birthday, he travels for free. After his 10th birthday, he has to pay half price. And they ask, you know, the conductor asks, do you have to pay for him? And then it's so easy for me to lie instead of telling the truth. And that's sort of, but the only way to override it is to light up the part of our head where we put on our shulrosh every morning. We're men put on their shulrosh.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Dr. Pelkowitz.